This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, Le Chablais.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded September 24th, 2025. Well, it's said extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures, and who could argue the times are anything but ordinary everywhere? But the old saw is especially pertinent for Venezuelans, who, despite having grown used to the bellicose rhetoric directed at them by the United States, are less accustomed to a U.S. attack fleet floating off the coast. Amidst this unusual circumstance, a special plenary of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela Congress was convened earlier this month by the ruling PSUV to strategize against the latest Yankee aggression. Canadian activist Tyson Strandlin was there, attending as a delegate to the extraordinary plenary session and the JPSUV Youth Congress. Tyson's a Métis activist and serves as general secretary to the Popular Democracy Movement formed here in Victoria last year. Tyson Strandlin in the first half. And Monday, Italy's major unions staged a general strike in defiance of their government's assistance in Israel's genocide against Palestine. Ports, train stations, civic buildings, schools and other essential services shut down in multiple cities, effectively bringing the nation to a halt. As opposition grows in Europe and around the globe, Israel is unrepentant, employing every tactic it can to shut up critics and turn back the rising tide. Palestinian scholar, author, and journalist Ramzi Baroud is one in the crosshairs. He and his publication, The Palestine Chronicle, are accused of aiding terrorism, an application of lawfare deployed in defense of the rogue state. Dan Kovalik is a lawyer, educator, labor, peace, and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author, and filmmaker. Dan's represented unions whose membership were targeted by Colombia's far-right death squads, and he's taken on Ramsey's and the Palestine Chronicle's case. Dan's book titles include No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interest, The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care, and his latest, co-authored with Jeremy Kuzmarov, Syria, Anatomy of Regime Change, set for release next week. Dan Kovalik in the lawfare trenches in the second half. But first, Tyson Strandlin and extraordinary Venezuela, resisting empire after all these wars. Welcome back to the program, Tyson.
Hi, glad to be here as always.
Well, it's always great to speak with you. Now you're back. This is your second trip to Venezuela in less than a year. What happened at this special plenary?
Well, this was an extraordinary plenary called for on account of the extraordinary circumstances that Venezuela and Latin America are facing right now as a result of U.S. aggression and the presence of U.S. warships off Venezuela's coast. I think there's a lot of significance of the fact. Moreover, it was called on September 11th and September 12th. September 11th being the anniversary of the fascist coup backed by the United States against the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende in Chile. So a lot of meaning there for that. The plenary was largely to discuss this again, this very urgent issue.
And how did the last time we spoke in November, when you were just back from being invited to the special, well, not special in that case, but the youth conference, you were invited specifically. Is that the case again today? Did they send you the invite and say, come on down, Tyson?
Yes. They covered my cost to go there and everything. They would, you know, they like to have Canadians and Americans and representatives from other Latin American countries there to actually see what's going on in the country, because obviously, you know, here in Canada, we get a lot of misinformation. And so it's a great opportunity to be able to share that on your show and progressive media outlets like that.
Well, so now what we've seen in the news up here, and of course, the news that we get is we have to strain our incredulity whenever we witness it, especially coming from the state broadcasters here. But what we have seen is an American flotilla, an armada off the coast, threatening all kinds of things against Venezuela and the leader who they've declared, President Maduro, as being a narco-terrorist, amongst other things. They also have been attacking vessels, ocean-going vessels, small vessels for the most part. Three so far, according to the American president, have been destroyed. Can you tell me anything about those attacks and how they are being received within Venezuela, within the media there? And do we have the names of any of those killed?
Yes. So a couple things here. First of all, I think it should be pretty obvious to anybody that, you know, this is not how traditionally the presence of narco traffickers in international waters or in territorial waters are dealt with, right? Typically, you would see, especially when you've got a highly trained, overqualified military like the United States, and it's very special troops that are boarding and destroying these vessels in some cases. You know, typically what would be done is you would seize the vessel, you would arrest the people on board, and you would seize the illicit materials which are apparently being smuggled. But the fact is, they have destroyed everything, and I think quite conveniently, because now there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever. The Venezuelan people are completely outraged by this. They're demanding investigations into these things. You know, if there's narco trafficking taking place, then the United States has an obligation to prove that. But
even if that was the case, even if these were drug smugglers, which seems again a real stretch to believe that in open boats, hundreds and thousands of miles away from the United States, moving in the opposite direction, at least according to the first report, these and filled with people instead of bales of cocaine or whatever it would be, that these are drug boats. But even if they were, an attack on boats that you think might be carrying contraband, or even that you know are carrying contraband, preemptively blowing them out of the water is illegal. This is more like an assassination. This is, you know, piracy on the high seas and this sort of stuff anyway.
And that's right. And most of the people who have been murdered by the American warships have been Venezuelan fishermen, tuna fishermen. And you know, they had nothing to do with any sort of drug smuggling or narco trafficking. And I think there's some really important evidence for this as well. For starters, the United Nations has an annual report on drugs. And from 1999 until 2025, never once in any of these reports is Venezuela mentioned as a relevant country for the trafficking of drugs. And even the DEA, you know, the DEA, which is actually very compromised and has a political agenda, its assessment reports from 2024 and 2025 never mention Venezuela or the fictional cartel that Maduro is apparently the head of in their own reports either. The vast majority, at least 81%, of all the drugs that go from Latin America to the United States, they go from the Pacific to ports in California and elsewhere. So, you know, if the United States was legitimately concerned about narco trafficking, their ships would be on the other side of the continent. This is just another completely illegitimate justification for regime change, just like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which we know how that turned out.
Well, and what about the identities? Now, you say that these guys were fishermen, tuna fishermen. Do we have their names? Has there been public memorials? Has there been public funerals? I ask this because I can't find any reference so far to the names of these people killed. And there is some question early on, even coming from officials within Venezuela, that the first attack, at least, was AI generated. Can you dispel that allegation that this was just all fakery? And who are these people being killed? And are there public remonstration and funerals and so forth? And the names of these people, do we know them?
Right. I don't have names with me at the moment, but I know while I was there, there was discussion about, you know, the commentary from a number of families from some of these fishermen. But you're right also that at least one of the attacks, there's serious doubt about as to whether or not it was real. There was a lot of really unusual circumstances and evidence. And then on the other hand, there's also the vessels which have just been boarded. You know, there was a fisherman's boat which was boarded for at least 8 hours. Again, just a humble fisherman, unarmed, completely over the top kind of action by the American Navy, which I think is largely provocative as well. Like, you know, the Venezuelan people have shown a lot of restraint. The Venezuelan forces have shown a lot of restraint and patience in not being goaded into, you know, something that could lead to escalating this aggression from the United States and could lead to an increase in the level of aggression, the military violence extending right to the Latin American continent itself, right? Because I think this is a really, really dangerous precedent. Right now, Venezuela is acting as a shield for all of Latin America. You know, the United States, for a long time, with the Monroe Doctrine and everything, they have financed coups, they have funded and armed far-right and fascist opposition. They've tried to use sanctions and other methods to destabilize progressive governments and any government which wouldn't bow to the United States. But the actual threat of a real military invasion is something much more unusual and something very, very serious.
Well, Venezuela's defense minister, Vladimir Padrino Lopez, said he calls this an undeclared war. He says you can already see how people, whether or not they're drug traffickers, have been executed in the Caribbean, executed without the right to a defense. He said this amidst the military exercises going on, the Venezuelan military exercises going on in response to this. And there's something of a national mobilization going on with. Can you describe what kind of defense infrastructure Venezuela has, especially as it relates to the people's militia and who Maduro is calling to mobilize?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Venezuelan people are a peace-loving people, and their policies internationally have always been about peace, and they want peace more than anything else. However, if there's one thing they're not going to suffer is, a colonial subjugation, and that's how they view this. And the Venezuelan militia is about 4.5 million people, and there's actually more people than ever now signing up for the militia in light of the U.S. aggression. You know, when I was there, the country is calm. It is resolved, but they're not unprepared. You know, Venezuela and the Venezuelan people, they will fight for every inch in the streets if the Americans actually think they're going to overthrow the government. They will fight into the jungles, and it would be a disaster, I think, in the long run for the United States, for the longer they actually tried to stay there. It would be something like another Vietnam or Afghanistan. The terrain in Venezuela is very, very complicated to fight in, and you know, the Venezuelan people are hugely united against this sort of foreign intervention. So, you know, while the United States clearly has a extremely, you know, unprecedentedly unparalleled military in terms of its funding and technology, the Venezuelans are not at all unprepared.
Well, the Attorney General, Tarek William Saab, says that what the Americans have done regarding the fishermen here are crimes against humanity. And he's called for the United Nations to investigate. What do you know if there's been a reaction to Venezuela's petition to the UN regarding this? Has the UN responded? Do you know?
I haven't heard yet about a response from the UN, but I think the UN certainly does have a legal obligation to do so. Obviously, I think even looking at the situation with Palestine and everything, there's increasing unity around that, but still a big shortage of action. You know, a lot of the times the action is coming too little too late. And I think nevertheless, though, like I say, because of the sort of precedent this poses to all of Latin America, I think that we need to have unity with Venezuela, not just in Latin America, but beyond as well. Like, this is an increasingly aggressive American imperialism that is really asserting itself in dangerous, dangerous ways. And if the UN is going to be continue to be a relevant and viable actor, then yes, it needs to take action to defend Venezuela's sovereignty and its territorial integrity and the right of the Venezuelan people to self-determination.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Canadian activist Tyson Strandlin. Tyson is General Secretary to the Popular Democracy Movement, formed here in Victoria, as I mentioned. He was just down in Venezuela for the special plenary of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela Congress, and he's back to tell us more about it. Tell us more about it, Tyson. Maduro, of course, addressed the plenary. What did he have to say, and what was the tone and tenor of the event as a whole?
I always enjoy listening to Maduro speak. Again, certainly there's a huge amount of unity and support for Nicolas Maduro. That much is incredibly evident, in the participation of local people in the Venezuelan democracy, which is very robust. And in terms of, you know, what's being discussed and what's being talked about by Maduro, it's resolute, it's calm, It's resolved, but it is militant, and it is not going to bend to the impositions of the United States. And it's clear that that has massive support in the country. We already mentioned the militia being mobilized. Many of them have also been called out to the military bases to receive additional training. Amongst the political leadership of the youth wing of the Socialist Party, they're for months now have been receiving special training in the case of a military invasion from the United States. This is the people. This is the country of the Bolivarian Revolution. Simón Bolívar, who was a fierce fighter for the homeland against in the face of colonialism and these sort of colonial impositions, and that spirit of Simón Bolívar is very much alive in Venezuela.
Now, Maduro has been in power for a dozen years now. He was the vice president under Hugo Chavez, and then after Hugo's death in 2013, took over. He's been there. And when you talk about his popularity, I've talked to a guest a couple of weeks ago that said that he fixed the last election, that it was a narrow thing by all accounts, that his popularity certainly isn't as strong as it was 10 years ago. I mean, and that's understandable in any context. I wonder, Tyson, after 20 years of the financial strictures put on against Venezuela in the wake of Hugo Chavez's ascension, are the people actually still supporting the Bolivarian Revolution, as you say, or is that support starting to weather and show its age?
Yeah, no, I completely disagree with that assertion. And, you know, being in Venezuela is one of the best things to make that very clear, because, like I say, the level of support for the government and for the Bolivarian Revolution is not only, in my opinion, resoundingly clear in their very robust democratic process, and a process which includes far more than just voting for president, voting for elected officials. It also includes the day-to-day operation of Venezuela's vast system of communes and making decisions about the projects and economic direction of like even small localities. It's a remarkable thing to witness, and seeing the level of support from Venezuelans for the Bolivarian Revolution, it's palpable in the streets, in massive marches in Caracas, in which numbers of people come out, which you would never ever see in a country like Canada. It's really clear to me that Maduro is one of the leaders in the world who has more support than most.
Well, we expect countries to rally around the flag when they're threatened from abroad, and Maduro himself has got this $50 million U.S. bounty on his head, yes, as a narco-terrorist and other things that come, frankly, out of the rectums of American propagandists, as far as I can tell. He says that it's an imperial plan for regime change to impose a U.S. puppet government in Venezuela so that they can steal or at least control the oil resource there. That's not difficult to believe, as that is exactly what they were doing forever before Hugo Chavez. But even the opposition figure, Enrique Capriles, he's run for the presidency twice. We've got to let people understand that this Venezuela is not a communist country, a single party rule or a cult of personality in Maduro's, that there is a vibrant right wing. They've got oligarchs that are free to roam around. There's a upper class there that own the media, the major media. It's not a simple place, Venezuela, to be put into simple boxes as the media in the north would have us believe it is.
No, absolutely. And, they face real challenges as well. And sometimes people look to those challenges and want to blame the government. But just like Cuba, Venezuela is faced with hundreds and hundreds of separate economic sanctions that make running the country in the typical way very difficult. But nevertheless, the standards of living for the Venezuelan people continue to rise despite these sorts of sanctions. And, they have many rights and opportunities and things available to them that you wouldn't have found in the Venezuela before Chavez, and you won't find in many other Latin American countries. But you mentioned something really important, and that's the oil. Venezuela has some of the largest oil reserves in the world. And we know how the U.S. operates and how often the regime change and how often the foreign intervention is linked to this particular resource. And that's another thing that Maduro did mention multiple times. And the Venezuelan people voiced their determination that the United States will not get a single drop of it. And if they're going to invade and they think they're going to get their hands on it, they will sooner blow up the reservoir. They'll blow up the refineries, then let them fall into U.S. hands.
Well, the Americans control oil in a number of different ways, and one of them is controlling the supply. So if they can choke off the supply from Venezuela's oil to drive up prices on the world markets, it benefits them to do that. And we've seen that happen in other places, too. So it's not always getting the oil, even though they stole the all of the Venezuelan oil distribution stations throughout the United States, which is considerable, and gave it to Juan Guaido, as I recall. The people who run Juan Guaido, the student in Miami now. Speaking of Miami, there's another aspect to this as well. The Tren de Agua, the TDA so-called, has been declared by the Americans as a foreign terrorist organization. Those claims have been used to gin up a casus belli for war against Venezuela by saying that these so-called immigrants are actually agents, or gangsters, coming in to the United States to destroy them from the inside out, to rot them with drugs and vice and stuff, I guess, and that constitutes an actual invasion of a sort. And so therefore, the Americans are this is how the story is being laid out. For our listeners, don't think that I believe any of this for a moment, but who is Tren de Agua, and what do you make of these claims being made by the administration in the United States?
Honestly, this sort of unhinged rhetoric is not only extremely divisive, I think it's completely reasonable to characterize it as fascist. You know, the United States has some serious, serious problems of its own, economic, social, political problems. The American people, their standards of living are falling more and more. And, you know, it's under these sorts of conditions where fascist rhetoric and fascist regimes find fertile soil to spread their sorts of messages, right? It's in the conditions of economic insecurity and real legitimate kind of concern about the future, how people are going to pay their bills, how their, you know, kids are going to find jobs, how they're going to pay the rent, etc. That's where these sort of things are able to really take hold. And it's extremely, extremely dangerous and should be absolutely condemned because, you know, it's just scapegoating, right? Like the American people, they're looking for someone to blame for their very real problems. And the U.S. ruling class is happy to point the finger at anyone else other than the exploiters. It's the immigrants. It's trans people. It's women. It's all these things. And no wonder we're seeing such a backsliding of rights in the United States and some really dangerous kind of precedents.
Well, Trump sent a letter to the Senate, and he claims that he, under Article 2 of his constitutional authority, this is a part of the War Powers Resolution, that he was acting within the law when he blew up those boats, saying that the, quote, extraordinarily violent drug trafficking cartels have complex structures with financial means and paramilitary capabilities, and goes on to say that this therefore justifies the use of military force against them. But oddly, I find very strange that I'm reading this at the publication online of the Atlantic Council, not exactly your left-wing operation. And they, in an article that is titled, "Was Trump's Strike on Alleged Venezuelan Drug Boat Legal?" question mark. It's amazing to me that something like the Atlantic Council would be questioning the president and the legality of his actions when you would expect them to be fully in support of anything that this type of government does. Does this, do you think, indicate some kind of fracture in the ruling clique in the United States?
Well, I think we've already been witnessing that. I mean, the political situation in the United States right now, the people are extremely polarized, and that goes also for the ruling classes. I think there is a serious division right now on, you know, how to move forward. That, you know, this is also something that played out to some extent in the most recent U.S. elections, right? It wasn't so much about a fundamental change of course in many ways. It's largely about the way imperialism is sort of presented and the sort of detailed strategies. But, you know, one other thing I wanted to speak to, you mentioned the huge amount of money involved in these narco trafficking operations and stuff that these organizations have. Well, 85% of profits from narco trafficking stay in the United States. You know, they're laundered through commercial banking, through real estate, through casinos, through cryptocurrency. And this has been going on for a long time. And this is even recognized by leading officials in the United States. A number of the large banks in the United States have even received fines for their demonstrable involvement in laundering this huge amount of money that comes from narco trafficking. It actually adds up to 2.7% of U.S. GDP. And, you know, since 2008, 2009, the financial crisis, these funds have been used to help stabilize the U.S. economy. So, again, you know, when we're talking about the instability politically, I think it's a result of the instability economically, right? Capitalism has these inherent contradictions built into it that are not so easily resolved.
Tell me now, Tyson, what of your group here in Victoria, the Popular Democracy Movement, you're bringing back your reports from Venezuela to them, presumably. Are you guys meeting to share the word further afield than Guerrilla Radio?
Yeah, you know, certainly. The trouble is that not many of the Canadian media outlets are so so willing to entertain you know, the news and reports that come out of Venezuela. Nevertheless, you know, I certainly feel an obligation to help try and spread this as much as possible. So again, thank you for letting me talk about this on your show. I'm hopeful that we can arrange maybe some public discussion, public meetings on this, because there's just way too much disinformation out there about Venezuela, right? And I mean, this is also part of the problem with like expat politics, right? The people who leave Venezuela are usually not the ones who support the Venezuelan government. That's not always the case. You know, some go for very, you know, normal kind of economic reasons. The country's facing all kinds of sanctions and threats from the United States. So nevertheless, though, it's not kind of a normal sample of people who leave any country to try and get the politics that way. Not that there's that many Venezuelans who are being platformed to talk about the situation in the country, but those who are often like Juan Guaidos.
How, Tyson, do people find out more about Popular Democracy? Do you have a site?
Yeah, we've got a website. It's populardemocracymovement.com. And we post our statements there. We post videos and we'll post this interview there as well. But certainly there's lots of opportunities to come and have a chat and get involved in meetings, events, because yeah, there's a lot to be done in the world, you know?
You're not kidding. I'm going to be talking after the break with Dan Kowalik about Israel's use of lawfare and its attacking of a friend of the show, Ramzi Baroud, and the Palestine Chronicle. Do stick around for that. Thanks a lot, Tyson, for coming back on the show and telling us a little bit about your trip in Venezuela.
Always a pleasure. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Good, bad, and ugly news on Guerrilla Radio at guerrilla-radio.com. That's Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every week.
Charlie Kirk's in the news for taking his last breath in front of thousands who watched his death felled by an assassin of unknown creed who had the opportunity to do the deed. And the right's got a martyr to do what they will now that their man was killed. Charlie Kirk's in the news and the algorithm farms and every troll in the world's up in arms, raking in the views center, right and left, leaving no tendency bereft of a portion of the harvest of rage that then prepares the next stage. Now the president's eager to tell us how they're gonna use this for inspiration to make America great again, or at least to show how it must be time to suspend democracy. Cooks in the news, and what's been sown will now be reaped like we've been shown by our corporate overlords, whose songs we sing when they play the chords. However it goes, the reaper gets paid. Whoever wins, the money gets made. Charlie Kirk's in the news. It's what one more step towards the civil war, the one that's almost inevitable, or at least so very predictable. The algorithms he used to use so well, that were the sword by which he fell.